This week on Local Motion, part two of a special series produced by KD&K and Carbondale Arts in anticipation of the 50th annual Carbondale Mountain Fair happening July 23rd to the 25th. 50 years ago, people gathered in a small park in Carbondale to celebrate art, music, and community. That gathering became the Carbondale Mountain Fair. Hear the voices, stories, and sounds as we take you on a journey of 50 years of the fair. This is KVNF.
As we approach this great change of age, 2012 is rolling up on us. The Hopi prophecy has been fulfilled, the Tibetan prophecy, and a whole handful of others. And what that points to is the end of one calendar and the beginning of a new one. What will make the difference on this big watershed is our emotional state. The Hopis say that we have to create a you and me world instead of a you or me world. And so this time is called the time of choice. You look into every choice in your relationship, across the counter, in traffic, and you ask yourself, is this you or me, or is this you and me? And it's up to each one of us moment by moment to create a you and me world.
It amounts to holy writ, although it's probably not carved in stone and stashed away in the closet like a skeleton. They are the indispensable guidelines of the fair passed on year to year since the beginning. Taken for truth by all, they have become a true source of the power and magic of the Carbondale Mountain Fair.
The thing about the mountain fair, and I think this is important to talk about, it has certain ethos that when I came on board, I was told this is what I had to follow. Most people have to be volunteer. As the years have gone on and our world is, you know, it's a little harder, there's a few more people I pay. But overall, it's all volunteer. 350 people show up in that park and make this thing happen. It's incredible. And that is a true testament to what makes this fair special. So we pay a few more people, but not much. Most of it's volunteer, and that's a very strong part of the fair and why the fair is different from many other festivals, almost any other festival I've worked. Sure, you might have your volunteers that work to get a ticket into the event, but this is a free event. These people are doing it mainly for a T-shirt. So they, you know, that was important. I could not get sponsorship. Well, I could, people could give us money. But we couldn't have banners. So there was a few areas. When I first came on board, Carbondale Arts did have the Coca-Cola booth. No other vendors were allowed to sell sodas, which now when you think in things, obviously that has changed because Coca-Cola is not good for you. And what the heck were we selling it for? But we had the market on that. And we would make maybe $2,000. And so their booth always, you know, it's the Coke trailer thing. So that was a little jarring, but they were allowed because we were making money. I had to fight like hell to allow New Belgium to be able to have anything on their cups or anything. But New Belgium had been an incredible partner with us for many years. They were a company that had all the things we believed in. They were sharing profits with their... So, I mean, they represented what we wanted to represent. So I felt we should try to at least give them a little notice. And they made a lot of money for us and gave us a lot of incredible deals. So that was a bit of a fight to just be able to have their logo on the cups. But I did win out there. And they were allowed to have wristbands that had their name on it. And so basically the cantina, those people that are part of our cantina get to have recognition, but that's it. Otherwise, you know, I can thank you from the stage. You get your name in the program, you'll get love all year long, but you won't have big banners. And honestly, as hard as it is sometimes, because I'd love to get some big bucks, I think it's really been a huge part of why the spirit of the fair has been able to retain so much. So I always follow those. Also, we don't charge. Every year, almost every year, whenever we get maybe a new board or town council gets new people, they ask, well, have you ever thought about charging the fair? Well, I mean, sure, be great. Think of the money we could make, but it wouldn't be the same. Can't do it. Can't do it. We've got to preserve this magic.
That's a local billionaire that I'm not going to mention his name, but Jeff Britt and I worked on his house for years and years. And he came to the fair, and Jeff Britt and I walked him around and kind of showed him things and explained things. And he said, you know what? I'd kind of like to sponsor this. I'd kind of like to sponsor something. And Jeff and I looked at each other and we told him, you can't. Right. This isn't done that way. And it was such a moment. It's like, you don't tell a billionaire that stuff. And I mean, then you get to thinking, okay, who does this? You know, nobody shuns that, you know, that kind of money and that kind of power. And it was a powerful moment that we were actually able to say, no, you can't do that. Do you see Budweiser signs here? Do you see Coke signs? You don't see any of that. This is put on by Carbondale. It was a moment, you know, that was really huge for me. It meant a lot to me. This isn't for you. You can't really sponsor it. I mean, I appreciate the offer and everything, but no. And it was powerful.
That's a great story.
Who gets to do that? Who gets to turn down billionaires?
As things got busier and wilder, overnight security became necessary. But clearly, a schlub of a rent-a-cop wouldn't do for the Carbondale Mountain Fair. How about a budding concert pianist, a classical music conductor, and a newspaper reporter? Here's reporter John Colson.
I joined what we called the A-Team, which was the nighttime security force for the weekend. We would get crazy at the fair all day, and then we'd have to stay awake all night to make sure people didn't sneak into the park and steal stuff from the booths. And we did that with the help of various substances that helped to keep us awake. And at that time, two guys who are now lamentably gone from us, Ray Adams and John Robin Sutherland, were the ones who dragooned me into the A-Team. I don't know how they got involved. We would just stay awake for basically three straight days. And at night, we would roam the park and have some pretty strange adventures. Another year, we had a guy who used to live here named Mike Spear, who joined us on the A-Team for a couple of years in a row, but one in particular, he got separated from us and wandered off and went into a booth and fell asleep leaning up against a beer keg in the booth. And he just went out. And it wasn't until the next morning when we went to wake him up that he said, oh, where's the beer keg? I was leaning against a beer keg. And it turned out that someone had come in and stolen the beer keg out from under him without waking him up. We never caught anybody in the act of trying to steal anything, which was either really lucky or just really dumb on our parts. We heard that things got stolen every now and then, but it didn't happen much. One year, we had some cocaine to keep ourselves awake. And one of us, Ray, had just taken a snort, and all of a sudden he saw a cop car pull up next to what was then an annual and impromptu jerry-built stage, and he decided to go over and talk with the cop. I don't think I should name the cop, but he leaned in to talk to him, and this big rock of cocaine fell out of his nose and onto the cop's lap. And the cop looked down at his lap Then he looked up at Ray and said, "Ray, you're a mess," and drove off. No words of approbation or caution or potential for arrest, nothing, which I took as a really good sign for the humanity quotient, humanitarian quotient of the Carbondale Police Force. They were pretty forgiving back then.
Back in the day, there was a bench right where the sound booth is now, and there was just a tiny little sound booth and a bench and a porta potty right behind it. That was the fair. And one of my favorite stories is Fred Williams was the police chief at the time. And we all volunteered for different security things, and John Robin and Ray Adams always had the nighttime. And they'd just walk around from booth to booth and spend the night, and everyone knows what they were doing. So one night, Fred, I was coming off my shift, and John Robin and Ray were coming on. Fred shows up with a box of powdered donuts and says, "Do you guys want any?" And of course, John Robin and those weren't hungry at the time. So Fred went into the porta potty and came out with white powder all over his nose, and he turns to him and goes, "Want some?"
In the early years, a lot of energy was focused every year on building the stage, which was then dismantled at the end of the weekend. Brad Hendricks, former town trustee and longtime Mountain Fair volunteer, remembers how they did it.
From then on, I pretty much busied myself with the construction of the bandstand. And that partly because I'm in the construction business and it's something I could help. And it was a big job. You know, we used to put up a big, enormous bandstand every year. We'd start Thursday afternoon before the fair and have it done Friday in time and then tear it down the next Monday. It'd be gone. One of the things I kind of wanted to mention was some of the early people that did that, their share. And then it's just kind of forgotten. Now, Jimmy Santa Cruz is a good example. I believe Jimmy pretty much single-handedly built the first bandstand, or single-handedly with his crew, and then was certainly active in the first couple of them. And then he backed out, like you do. You do your share, and then you let somebody else come on. And not very many people remember that those days. Tim Villiere used to come in with a whole crew of guys, and I'd be nominally in charge of building the bandstand, and we'd be down there tacking stuff up, and I'd hear a whoop and look over, and here'd be Tim and five or six guys, and they're on Tim's payroll on the clock, and they'd roll in at noon on Saturday or on Friday, and that bandstand would go right up, you know. Bill Bullard used to spend a lot of energy with that. He'd bring over slabs and logs and his truck to set stuff. Rick Lawrence was in a couple of years, and Rick would bring some crew too. You know, some of these guys not only helped in that they were there and helping, but they had guys on their payroll. This was money coming out of their pocket and over their building stuff. A lot of people contributed to that bandstand that have no idea they did, because what we would do for materials is we'd all know somebody who was at the stage of construction, and around the middle of July, you've got a lot of houses going up, and we'd find somebody that either was ready to frame a roof or a floor and just call the lumberyard and have their materials sent to the park instead of to the job site. They'd go into the bandstand, and then we'd tear them down and take them onto the job site, and the owner would have no idea that his roof or his subfloor was in the park for the weekend.
So they're finding out something tonight.
Well, nobody knows which one. I know Ronnie helped us with that. Rick, I think, did. I did on a job I did. There was Tim Villiere. There's a number of people that did that, and it was at a cost to nobody, and yet we had good material to work with, you know, so... because we could do it all without cutting it up. We'd clean it all up and have it on the job site, and you'd never know.
In the early days of the fair in the 70s, there really, the first few years, there was no stage at all. There was really no act going on in those first year or two, as I remember it. But in the late 70s, or middle 70s, actually, probably middle of the late 70s, a group of people started bringing over a flatbed trailer, and that was the stage for many years on a flatbed trailer. The H.P. Hansen and his partner Ben and Charlie would bring over their flatbed trailer, and then other local contractors would bring in the wood to build the stage. Bill Bullard was one of the one of the local contractors. Of course, he owned a sawmill, so he was able to bring in the good wood. Brad Hendricks would always bring wood and materials. And then a group of people would build that stage on that flatbed trailer, only to be taken down on Sunday evening. And then about, I'm thinking maybe 81, 82, something like that, the current, I don't know, maybe it's later than that, but the current gazebo was built. And if you know as well as I do, the marble plaque on the side of that gazebo is for Benjamin Reed. Ben Reed was a local carpenter who always donated his time and energy to building that stage in the 70s. Great guy, friend of everybody's, and that stage is named after Ben Reed.
Well, you know, we've been building that stage forever and sort of probably thought we always would. Sadly, I want to say 82 or 3, I don't remember exactly which year, my husband and Ben were hit some black ice on the way out of town, and there was a pretty nasty car wreck, and Ben survived the wreck. Ben was he was part of our crew with our logging show and sawmill operation up on the McNulty Ranch, and he was just a ladies' man around town. He was a dancing fool. Ben loved to dance. You know, you'd find him at the Nugget, you'd find him at the Mountain Man, you'd find him out just, you know, anywhere there was music, you know, any kind of road show, he was out there dancing. He loved to dance, and he sadly in the Stanford actually came to St. Mary's, and they took his heart for a transplant. It was the farthest east they'd ever come at that point in time. It was pretty cool. Anyway, so Ben did not survive. So we threw several benefits, and there were all these donations and stuff, you know, for Ben, and his family turned them over to us and said, "What is it that you would do with this to honor Ben?" And we're like, Mountain Fair, he loved it. You know, he would dance at Mountain. He was almost like Meredith used to be. He would start on Friday night and dance clear through to Sunday night. And so we ended up taking the money and building the Ben Reed Memorial Gazebo.
From the very beginning, the slideshow was enormously popular. Local photographer Jim Ryan began the practice of collecting photos of fairgoers and putting them together in a slideshow at the end of the fair on Sunday night. That practice lasted until 2017, though Jim didn't do it all those years. Here he is describing how it came together.
Dean Arneson and I did the first slideshow with real slides that we photographed during the day, developed them at my lab, and then synced them to music and showed them back on Sunday night at 9:30. It was a huge hit with all the locals. It was a nice way to wind down. We did that for 2 or 3 years. Then I did one with Willie Savarese, Becky Young, Grandbois did one, Patty Barry Levy did one. And it was the funnest thing to do because Carbondale is the volunteer capital of the world. I had a complete color darkroom, and that was the business I was in, so I could print. And I had what's called an E6 kit, and they developed ektachrome slides. So I lived over on Sopras Avenue, and I had the lab all set up, so I would go over every night after we got done and develop the slides, get up early, sync them to music, get ready to go again. And we did that 3 days in a row. The hardest part was syncing them to music and having the right slide come at the right song, that kind of thing. And it was important to us to make that happen. And it made people feel good, and they'd walk away going, that was cool. The fun part was is that nobody was inhibited. You know, I could just walk up, and I didn't even ask if I could take their picture. Sometimes I did if I didn't know them, but most of the time they'd go, "Are you the fair photographer?" I go, "Yeah." And then somebody would come running up going, "Have you seen that girl in a bikini sitting on the bench over there?" And I said, "No." And I'd walk over and she'd go, "Are you the fair photographer?" And I go, "Yeah." And she'd go, "Whoop." I go, "You're in the show."
And then you never wanted to miss Sunday night because Jim Ryan and Dean Arneson and Doug Arneson, they had a color photo lab at Redstone. And so they would go home and they would come back Sunday night and you'd have a slideshow of that weekend which was unheard of in those days. You know, it was not like we had digital cameras. Those guys would do the, and they were all over that park with their cameras. I bet Jim Ryan has pictures of the fair that, you know, thousands of them, because he was the man on the camera. And beautiful pictures, you know, and you'd see a lot of pictures of, he was good at zeroing on the little kids all dressed up, just how much fun they were having.
The slideshow at the end of the fair was just so magical, just to lie on your blanket after this wonderful, wonderful weekend and then watch the magic of the fair unfold and the faces and the expressions of joy and love was just so special. And oh my God, but the slideshow was such an undertaking. That was way before digital. There'd be these photographers that had to run their cameras and their film up to Aspen to the slide master and get all of those things developed and then go through them and put them together. And this gorgeous slideshow was just another thing. And it makes me think of that whole magic of just watching that little teeny park, watch it just come together with all of this support and all of these people working together in cooperation for a common goal was so magical. Really it was. And truly being part of it was such a sense of great pride of being able to be part of this thing that brought so many people together and brought so many people such joy and happiness and love. And, you know, it's just always been such a cool thing. And it doesn't really repeat itself. And, I've gone to so many festivals, and I just don't ever feel like it. There's just nothing like the Carbondale Mountain Fair.
Perhaps the most charismatic of all locals who ever appeared on the gazebo stage, Conan the Barbarian performed a lot during the 80s and early 90s. Sexy, buff and hairy, and tight pants. He could also belly dance and balance a very sharp sword on his nose. Every woman secretly loved him, and every guy was secretly jealous.
That was really fun, because that same year, I was also dancing with Conan. Because there were a bunch of us that were in Conan's belly dance class, and he was asked to dance, and he was like, well, do you want to be in the fair? And we're like, of course! So it was a really fun, that was a really fun performance. You know, Conan, well, of course, was in his little tight pants with his sword on his head, and it was just wonderful just being on stage with him. And he was a belly dancer, but he also gave lessons. And at the time, there were a bunch of us taking classes with Mabel McDonald, and she brought him in as a guest teacher. And then he would teach a lot, so we were just all taking classes with him all the time. And, we put together a performance. And he was just so, he was just so much fun to watch. He would always perform bare-chested with these, like, painted on pants and high black boots and a sword on his head and bend over backwards doing just very dramatic stuff. And he was just incredible to watch and incredible to dance with. And
one classic story, Conan used to be a belly dancer performing at the fair. He was a local guy. And then I don't know if he just stopped dancing or moved away or what, but Thomas, one year, dressed up as a belly dancer and called himself Gonad the Barbarian and did a semblance of a belly dance on stage. That was priceless.
One of the enduring and beloved quirks of the Carbondale Mountain Fair is the Carbondale police deputies dressing in tie-dye. It's always surprising to the newbies and always proudly proclaimed by the locals. Here, the Band of Heathens shout out to the cops on stage at the 2010 Mountain Fair, and we hear Drew Handy, Jory and Peg DeVilbiss, Lori Loeb, and John Colson extol the virtues of cops in tie-dye.
We'd like to thank the Carbondale Police for electricity and tie-dye shirts.
one of my favorite scenes is Gene Stilling, you know, our police chief who wears his tie-dye, and all of the policemen wear their tie-dyes, and that's just wonderful.
I know, how cool is that?
That is so cool.
Our cops go around in tie-dyes. I love that.
It's one of my favorite parts.
Yeah. My friends will come into town and will take pictures with the policemen in their tie-dyes because they just, it's the coolest thing.
How cool is that? What other town does that?
Oh, and another thing I love is you know, when the police all dress up in their tie-dye. And everybody loves that because it makes them human and part of the fair.
I was mighty impressed by that. I thought any police department that can even subtly make fun of itself that way is a pretty good police department to have.
Here are the two police chiefs, Fred Williams and Gene Schilling, tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth about how the Carbondale cops came to wear tie-dye at the Mountain Fair.
Greg Knott, who's now the chief of police in Basalt, and an officer named Tony Kornostevich, they came to me and wanted to take some old police uniforms and tie-dye them. And I was thinking at the time, well, I don't know if that's a good idea or not. So I went ahead and let them do it. And that's where today, the tie-dye with the police department, that's how it originated. It was a big hit. I think citizens were comfortable in contacting us and talking to us. It made people feel like we were the same, we were them. We were human. We weren't straight-laced cops. We'd have visitors from out of town, out of country. I remember French, Japanese people, people from different states just coming up to us and saying they couldn't believe officers were wearing tie-dye shirts. It just blew them away and just made us much more approachable to the citizens. It's a great thing. I think that's has helped our police department over the many, many years to community policing. I think that's why this police department has been so successful over the years. 1994.
We get so many requests for photos. People that say my friend or my uncle or my whatever is an officer in whatever, and I don't believe that they'd ever believe cops would do this. And it's international people also. Huh. I'm from England. They'd never believe this, and we get that photo opportunity. So as far as I know, and of course I could be wrong, we're the only law enforcement agency in the United States that does that. There may be others, but I don't know about them if there is.
This podcast was created with the same love and care that the Carbondale Mountain Fair has been created with for 50 years. Special thanks go to Luke Nessler, Amy Kimberly, Terry Glassnap, Steve Cole, Carbondale Arts, KD&K, and the Carbondale Historical Society. Stay tuned for uploaded podcasts and photos coming mid-September at carbondalearts.com.